Now,
Okay.
first, while you're figuring that out, where are you located?
I am in San Luis Obispo, California.
Okay.
Yeah, so West Coast. I'm about halfway between LA and San Francisco.
Understood. No, I was born in Santa Monica, but didn't really spend much time there.
Nice.
Although I have a ton of family in Los Angeles who I haven't even met, so.
You spending a lot of time on the East Coast then. You need to come out here, Phil. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the 343 podcast. My name is John Pronich, and I am your host. And on today's episode, I brought on Phil Shane. Now, Phil Shane is probably best known right now for his multiple roles on beIN Sports. If you've watched a Barcelona or Real Madrid game here in the last few years in the United States, you've likely heard the tag team of Phil and Ray Hudson. You can also find Phil on other beIN shows such as The Locker Room and The Extra. But when someone is limited to just a few minutes of talking time on these shows, they might not get to say everything that they wanted. So it's no surprise that guys like Phil and Alexi Lawless and Taylor Twellman are jumping on social media to try to go more in depth and interact with people. But with just 140 characters on Twitter and kind of unlimited on Facebook, but limited in the sense that it's still social media, it can get dangerous. Which is why I invited Phil Shane to join me on the podcast. Now, the hottest topic in the soccer Twittersphere is, of course, promotion relegation. I saw Phil getting into it with several people and thought it would be great to give Phil a forum to go a bit more in depth, whether I agree with him or not. Phil and I spent over an hour discussing many different things. He gave his thoughts on the growth of MLS and US soccer. Of course, he gave his perspective on promotion relegation. I fired back with thoughts and questions and a bunch of other stuff. We talked about investments from billionaires and also discussed giving teams with lower budgets opportunities to grow into something bigger. Now, like I said, whether or not we got anywhere with this conversation can be questioned. I don't think him and I changed each other's minds, but the fact that he came on the show and dove in head first into certain topics is a step in the right direction. Not just when we're talking about mainstream media, but just overall soccer talk in general. So I think this conversation is something that everybody's going to enjoy, but during our chat, Phil rightfully states that now it's time for people to do more than just talk, do more than just chime in. It's time to start offering ideas and offering plans and for people to start putting their money where their mouth is. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Phil Shane, and I look forward to continuing conversations, productive conversations with everybody in the future. Thank you and enjoy. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Summit, 343's live in-person coaching, education, and networking experience, taking place July 29th through 31st in Las Vegas, Nevada at Palms Resort and Casino. This year, The Summit will be headlined by Hugo Perez, Sasha Vandermost, and Brian Kleiben. Hugo Perez is a former U.S. men's national team player and U.S. youth national team coach. During Hugo's time with the youth national teams, he was widely recognized as having implemented something different, a possession-based style of play. Sasha Vandermost is currently a scout for the Mexican Football Federation. Formerly the academy director at Chivas USA, Sasha is the one who brought Brian Kleiben on board at Chivas, and through his leadership, built what came to be known as one of the best youth academies in the country. And 343's own Brian Kleiben, who is now with LA Galaxy's Youth Academy, is continuing to develop players for the professional game with a style and in a setting that is unlike any other in the United States today. Topics at the summit will include individual activities, implementing style of play at team and club level, scouting, session planning, getting parents, players, and club members to buy into what you're trying to do, and more. This is an opportunity to dive deeper into how it's done with presentations from guys who have actually done it. Find more information about the summit by visiting 343coaching.fm, that's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm, and clicking on live services in the upper right corner. Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the 343 podcast. Today on the podcast we have Phil Shane from beIN Sports. And Phil, I guess I should ask, did I say your name right?
Yes, you did. Donkashane.
Okay, cool. So Phil, thank you for joining us. I frequently, I think, interact with you on Twitter, and I feel very privileged that you would even take the time out of your day to respond to some of my tweets that aren't always the nicest, I guess you could say. And then for you to give me some of your time to come on the show really means a lot to me, so I appreciate that. I guess we can start with a little bit about Phil. Give me a little history of who you are and how you got to where you're at today and what you're up to these days.
Well, I guess first of all, I think anyone who really loves this game is a fan at heart, no matter whether they're in broadcasting or coaching or just, I guess, the most vital part, the ones that are actually putting their money down to pay and buy the tickets and watch. So when it comes to Twitter, most of the time, I would say everything's fair game. And, I try and respond to everything, even things that maybe get a little heated, because, as you pointed out, 140 characters, black and white. First of all, even just getting sarcasm is almost impossible, let alone cynicism or the nuances of everything. So there's no problem between our communication on Twitter, and I am enjoying the possibility of elaborating just a little bit more over this next half hour or so. Born in California, but grew up in Florida. And this was back before NASL, the original, and grew up in a single parent home with my mother, and became enamored with sports, and specifically sports broadcasting. I was the type of kid that would, I don't even know nowadays if people even know what they are, but those old transistor radios, the little portable ones, sneak it under my pillow at night just to try and move it one little fraction of a turn at a time, to see what might be lurking in between the numbers on the dial, and listening into an Atlanta Braves broadcast or a Baltimore broadcast or a Yankees broadcast. Or Cleveland. I even remember once, and I don't know where it was, maybe it was from Arizona or something, the skies aligned and I was able to hear Vin Scully. It's one thing to listen to some of these guys on television, but in my mind, radio is really the perfect canvas for almost all sports, because the vividness that you can paint a picture in your mind is even more vivid than what you can watch on some of these ultra high def TVs. And that really was what grabbed my attention when it came to sports broadcasting. At the same point, right around that time, on PBS, don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but in addition to Spanish broadcasting, back before Univision, when it was SIN, and they would have games every so often, the only other real avenue to watch, especially if you didn't really like indoor, was on PBS. And they would have a couple of shows midday on Saturdays and Sundays, one highlighting the action from Germany called Soccer Made in Germany with the legendary Toby Charles. And then Mario Machado was the voice of Star Soccer, which highlighted the old English First Division. And that was right about the time that me and my friends had started to play. And what would happen on the weekends was we would watch those. And if I remember it all, it almost perfectly synced up with This Week in Baseball. So I would kind of watch This Week in Baseball, then flip it over to watch Soccer Made in Germany. And as soon as it was over, it's like me and my friends, we'd all hop on our bikes and ride to the school and hop over the fence and try and duplicate what we had just witnessed on television. There was NASL soccer of a sort already here, even some ASL back in the day, with the Toros and the Sharks, etc. But right about the end of '76, Steve David, the Trinidadian, who was, I guess, an unsung legend in NASL, was playing in Miami. And they actually had some broadcasts. And like I said, I was kind of hooked on sports broadcasts would listen, but then they weren't really drawing, and they moved up to Fort Lauderdale, and it was a total rebirth where they brought in the likes of Gerd Müller and Nene Kubiyas. Bernd Holzenbein was there, a lot of other Brits and the like, along with a certain Ray Hudson. And it was at Lockhart Stadium, and which was a lot easier and closer to get to than the Miami team was. And also, us being a year older, we would hop in my friend's mom's Volkswagen bus, and the whole gang of us would go down almost every single home game to watch the Strikers play. And it really opened my eyes. So I was already in love with sports and sports broadcasting. I mean, I was the type of kid that would be first in line at the 7-Eleven or the local newsstand just to get Street and Smith's or Athlon or Who's Who in American Baseball. But now all of a sudden, in addition to playing, getting a chance to watch some of these legendary stars on the field in front of me, it really hooked. I was fortunate enough that my high school had a broadcasting program, radio and television film production. Had a chance to do a little basketball in the gym, and that was shown, if I recall, on closed circuit during lunch. And it was more just fun, and I guess a way to avoid taking any other classes that might have been viewed as serious work. But it stuck with me to the point that when I started looking at colleges, even if it wasn't what I wanted to do or thought that I would be able to do, it was part of the criteria. And I looked at Bowling Green, and they had that in addition to a whole bunch of other things that were on my list. And again, it was more something to do that would be fun, hoping perhaps that I'd be able to make a career of it without really thinking about it. Had a few personal issues along the way, and it took me a little longer to get through. Took 6 years to graduate because my mom got sick, and I ended up paying for a lot of it myself. And I think it was after I went back to school that I really appreciated what the opportunity was and took it a little bit more seriously and tried to get as much experience in everything, be it the law courses I was taking, geography, computer science, or the broadcasting possibilities. And still wasn't sure what I wanted to do as a junior. It was one of those ones where I'm looking, okay, do I want to be a double major and a triple minor? But by my senior year, I just threw everything I had on my advisor's desk and said, get me out of here. I was fortunate enough that during the spring break of my senior year, I was able to go to New Jersey, and just driving around, saw just what was out there. And there's obviously a lot more radio, television, newspapers in the metro area than there was in Northwest Ohio. And just noted a few things in my book that when I got back to finish my senior year, made a few phone calls, and the station that I contacted was down in Princeton, but they didn't really have anything. They referred me to someone a little further north, and it's WCTC in New Jersey, which covers Rutgers. And I was able to talk to the news director there and came back out when I graduated, had an interview, and 4 weeks out of school, I was able to get the job doing news, and sports, getting a chance to do some play-by-play here or there. But it was also the time where, I don't know if anyone remembers Bob Riasso, still coaching, but he was the coach there. Very good recruiter, very good marketer, a good coach. And he had that year, Peter Vermees was a senior. Alexi Lalas was a freshman. And it was an amazing time for Rutgers over those next couple of seasons. And Bob Riasso had actually started a coaches show on WCTC that my boss did, but I helped. And when he found out how much I liked it, he pretty much handed the reins to me. And it was at that moment where maybe I didn't realize how big it could get, because again, we're still talking about that interim period between NASL and World Cup 94. But to realize that it was possible, at least in part, to do as a career what I loved as a fan, and just bit by bit through exposure and people calling up asking me to do things, doing some ASL games up in Patterson. Went back to Ohio for my career, did a Olympic qualifier there and some other action in Ohio. Went down to work with the Dallas Rockets because I really wanted to do more with soccer, and that was back in the USISL days with Francisco Marcos. And in Dallas that year actually was in the CONCACAF Champions Cup, and Thomas Dooley had come over with Kaiserslautern. They ended up playing, if I remember, even Hugo Sanchez was still playing with America that year. And it was a phenomenal season. I wanted to do broadcasting. It never really developed, so I did just help out in the front office wherever I could. But then the possibility of heading back to South Florida when the Marlins came around, and one of the radio stations I'd been looking at got the rights to the Marlins and turned all sports. They told me to get back in touch with them if that happened. It did, and I ended up being one of their first hires. Did more soccer broadcasting down there on local, regional. Had the chance to do some stuff internationally with world feeds, and even did the Copa America 93 and Copa America 95, which was that one where the United States beat Argentina 3-0 historically. And again, more and more, I just realized that was really what I wanted. But it was still a period in soccer in this country where, especially if you were English language, there weren't that many openings. You had indoor at a point, you had the regionals if you didn't mind doing some college here or there. But in all honesty, it really wasn't where we are today, nowhere near. But I was able to put together a reel clip, a clip reel, and sent that up to ESPN when it became certain that the US was going to get World Cup 94. And surprisingly, they were interested, although they already had everything locked up for 94. So they told me to keep my hat in the ring for MLS. And even then, it was just a bit of a surprise more and more. Okay, well, now you're in the final 10, you're in the final 7, you're in the final 5, you're in the final 3. And even just to that point was a blessing to come that close. But it was also the way that MLS worked, that the priority games were going to be scheduled on a Thursday where one of the guys could not do it. So I was able to step in and be the first voice of MLS. And it was an absolute thrill to be there on the day where First Division Soccer reappeared in the United States. And throughout that point to this, there have been a few detours along the way. There have been a few potholes and speed bumps, but I wouldn't trade a moment. I have been truly blessed to be able to do what I love, and I am grateful for everyone who appreciates it, who enjoys it, understanding that that might not be universal, but the one thing that I really hope that comes through is the fact that I do love this game. Maybe you might disagree with my conclusions, but the fact that I actually care and think through pretty much everything I say about it. And I think if there are differences, as we've done on Twitter and as we can do perhaps a little bit later in this interview, that at least we're coming at it from the same perspective, that we all love this game. And sorry for rambling on, but it's you said to kind of give the backstory, and I guess that's the nickel tour.
Okay, and with that, we have no more time left. No, I'm just kidding.
It's funny. As you were talking, I kind of started thinking about like the old boxing quote. Like you go into a fight with a game plan, and then as soon as you get hit in the face, every kind of all bets are off. And I came into this with a bunch of questions that I wanted to ask, but as you were talking, I thought of 20 more questions, and I'm just sitting here typing, 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 thinking of questions that I wanted to ask you.
Well, tell you what. I'll try and keep the answers a lot shorter. Go through the ones you want.
Not a problem at all. Not a problem. I guess. Okay. So I'll start with this. After covering soccer for X amount of years now, I don't know if we got an exact number, but what do you feel like you are most well versed in?
In all honesty, I don't know if I would consider myself well versed in anything. Just for the, I guess again, you talked about that old boxing quote. There's another one that the more you know, the more you realize, the less you know. I constantly am learning, and be it just talking with people, tweeting with people, watching games, trying to break down and analyze. Now, in the days of the internet, so many opportunities out there. I remember just last week looking at something online in regards to the way Jorge Sampaoli took what Bielsa had done. It was basically a coaching thesis and took it to the next level. And kind of detailed, kind of archaic. But to me, it was extremely interesting because I truly do want to understand what I'm seeing. Now, can I understand this with the same ability as someone who has done this from a playing perspective or a coaching perspective? No. But I've played club soccer in college. I could have basically sat on the bench in college, but I decided I wanted to play, so played club, actually played some semi-pro because there really wasn't even a USL at that particular point. But it was a dream that I had to give up, just partly because there was no money in it, and also partly because I was actually kind of a mediocre goalkeeper, although I would like to think what I could do if there were hundreds and hundreds of teams out there. But it wasn't meant to be. So, again, for me, being a student of the game, I don't think you ever stop learning, and I never want to assume that I know everything about anything.
Now, you mentioned always being a student of the game, and that's something that I've said before too, is that you constantly have to be scanning every bit of not only the internet but the field as you're watching games, or stadiums as you're going as you're going in, and things like that. Just constantly taking in everything, absorbing everything, and learning from every aspect of this sport that we all love. So we're all students, but when it comes to what you do at BN and what you've done as a career, what do you think describes you better, an educator or an entertainer, and why?
There was a great quote from Landon Donovan. Don't know if it was today or within the last week or so, talking about his breaking into broadcasting. That he has a good grasp on what's going on. He has a good grasp on what the players are feeling and going through. And he can't express himself. But the way he phrased it is, if I'm not entertaining, no one's going to be listening to me. And he referred back to a high school speech class he had where the teacher had mentioned 10% is what you say, 90% is how you say it. I've heard very similar, even in regards to in person and maybe in television, you kind of get the same, where it's not even how you say it, it's the body language. There's so many things that go into communicating. I would say, in direct answer to your question, though, it's not that I'm an educator, but I don't want to talk down to the audience. Now, that's probably less of a concern now than it might have been 20, 25 years ago when I was starting out. But back then, you still had some people that are still broadcasting today that would practically have to explain in their mind why or what offside was and what this rule was and what that rule was. And in my mind, all that really did was to, pardon the expression, piss off the fans that actually knew what was going on. So maybe what I tried to do earlier, and I find there's even less of a need to do it now, is instead of the what, to kind of go into the whys. So at that particular point, if you're not aware what offside is, the way that it could be presented is informative enough so you can learn. But at the same point, if you do what an offside is, you're not pulling your hair out or throwing stuff at the TV because it's soccer for idiots. I always try to treat the audience as being educated in the game, and I figured that if you weren't, my job was to make it interesting enough, and not even really to make it, but to convey it, because the sport has the passion. It's my job to convey that passion. And if you are a novice or a newcomer and you feel that passion, I think that you're more likely to watch again, pick it up yourself, maybe bring it up to someone you know that knows the game and learn. So I was never against bringing things up in a broadcast that might make someone scratch their head and go ask a few questions. I found that was, in my mind, a lot better than just kind of going through the elementary parts of the game. I think if it was boring to me, it would probably be boring to someone at home.
I think that's fair to say. I kind of have some questions that are kind of all in the same realm, but I want to go back to what you were talking about in your intro, and you said that there was kind of that limbo period between or leading into the 1994 World Cup, and you were trying to break into the scene, it sounds like, around that time, and it sounds like you were having conversations with people that were in the American soccer media already. What was the conversation like around that time? What were these people that were leading soccer in our country or covering soccer in our country at that time? What were they talking about? What was the focus on? And I guess a couple of questions to follow that with. What's changed today in those backroom conversations when you guys are trying to figure out how we're going to cover this or what's going to take the lead or those types of things. And I'm actually really curious, are a lot of those same people that were involved in 1994 and in that era, are they still around? Are they still the ones that are kind of directing things today?
Well, I wouldn't say they're directing. I wouldn't give that power to just individuals. But back in between, before there was really broadcasting, I know I did a lot of writing for Soccer America. And obviously the likes of Ridge and Mike and Paul, I mean, they've been around forever. I think Soccer America has obviously changed more due to the internet than due to the changing of the game. I think the fact that the game has grown still means that there's a possibility, even if they've had to change their focus. But there have been a lot of other magazines that were not able to adjust. Really hoping that this 442 US can take off, because I think that, again, the sport has so much passion in it that the more it's exposed, the more attractive it becomes. Now, in regards to what the conversations were like, it was kind of a soccer wasteland, and some of those people, I'm not saying they acted like it, but they were in those little oases where there was the possibility, be it Soccer Digest, Soccer America, USA Network, I know did a little bit here and there, ESPN in the fringe levels, and ESPN International really just starting out at that point. There were discussions, connections. I think people would try and help themselves as much as possible, but at the same point, there really wasn't much there. Now, once 94 became aware, I think there was a little bit of a push from a broadcasting perspective to basically get towards the front of the line. But at the same point, the fact that that came with the mandate for a first division gave everyone hope. There were a lot of people that knew broadcasting that didn't really know soccer. I think a lot of them have dropped along the way. Some that have stuck around have learned to appreciate soccer even more along the way. And I think a lot more soccer people have stepped in. I mean, you take a look at what Taylor Twellman has done, what John Strong has done. These are people that kind of grew up in soccer and then transitioned into broadcasting, which I think is amazing. I know Ty Keogh and I, when we were doing the ESPN games, it would be so frustrating that we would practically beg, can we just please go out to a park, grab 20 people that know the game, and teach them how to do television? Because it seemed as though that would be easier. And I know there's still some issues with production, especially in maybe some of the bigger markets, because there's so many other things that are pulling the talented TV people away, and maybe some of the smaller markets that just don't have the exposure. But I think on the whole, things have gotten a lot better. The conversations now, or the conversations then, were really, I hope we get a first division. What can we do to get a first division? What needs to be done to get a first division? Now, and I know there's a lot of this stuff on Twitter, in regards to single entity and promotion relegation and youth development, I think a lot of that is still being discussed, and I think that those are directions that many would like to head in. It's just at various speeds. So I would say, don't be surprised if everything that you and others are arguing about and pushing for on Twitter aren't the exact same things that many behind the scenes are arguing about and pushing for at the same time, just a little more quietly.
Why? Okay, I'm trying to organize my thoughts, I guess. Why isn't that talked about more openly on air or in mainstream soccer media, I guess? Why I still consider that to probably be more of a backroom conversation in regards to promotion and relegation and single entity and those types of things. And you're the one that opened the can of worms, by the way. So, yeah, but I still feel like that's a conversation that maybe isn't in the spotlight yet. And obviously, you know, it's something that a lot of people are highlighting on social media, but it hasn't been mentioned as much as we probably think it should be, or talked about as much as it should be. Why do you think that is?
Well, in the areas and avenues that might be open, pardon the expression, but I think we can all appreciate the great unwashed, all of us as fans, an MLS perspective on their broadcasts, MLS is focused on MLS. Even the NASL broadcasts that we do here on beIN Sports and that have been received very well, I know NASL, it's not that they say don't talk about MLS, don't talk about USL. It's just obviously, let's focus in on what's good about NASL. Now, there's 2 points from my perspective, and this has gotten me in trouble in the past, not so much lately, but if you don't talk about what's bad, if you see something that is just egregious in front of you, be it a certain play, maybe specifically a certain player, although I try and avoid that sometimes. Or a situation. If you don't recognize that, and then I turn around and talk about something that's really great, why should anyone believe me? If people can see with their own eyes if there's a problem and I'm ignoring it, why should they believe me when I say that something's good? So I think from a broadcaster's perspective, from a pundit's perspective, you have to be fair. Now, that doesn't mean unbiased. All of us come with our own beliefs and experiences. For example, there's a lot of people out there currently that I swear it seems as though they've only been following this sport in the last 5 years. And they don't even know what the Bob Bradley era was like, what the Bruce Arena era was like, what the Steve Sampson era was like, what Bora was like, what Bob Gansler was like, et cetera. They don't know about that 10 years of the soccer desert between the NASL and MLS. I'm not saying that they're wrong in their conclusions, and in the politest sense, maybe they're a little ignorant in some of the backgrounds as to why some of us might feel a little differently. But in some ways, you could argue that maybe we're stuck in the past and now's the time to go forward. We have talked about promotion relegation on BN Sports, especially in the locker room. We have talked about youth development and the problems therein. Same thing on the locker room. I know we're going to talk a little U.S., I believe, on Friday's locker room. Not so much today as we're wrapping up or getting ready for the Euros quarters. But it has been done. It's just really hard to do in a 2, 3, 5, even a 10-minute segment because there's so many details that go behind it. I mean, with youth development, you're talking about pay to play, but someone's got to pay. I don't see any coaches out there working for free, or at least not for that long, especially if they have a mortgage and a family to pay for. So some way you have to find a way to get that to work and to function. How do you want the pipeline to go? Do you want it to go through those smaller clubs, opening up the prospect of youth development and into promotion relegation? Some people have talked about banning travel soccer, saying it's a waste of money for all of that stuff. Just throw all of that money that's spent on hotel rooms and flights and bus rides and throw that into better coaching. But there's the drawbacks to that. Someone like a Clint Dempsey, for example, if he would have been stuck in Nacogdoches instead of getting the opportunity to drive 4 hours into Dallas, who knows what would have happened. So, again, I think it's very difficult the way that modern media is set up in these short segments, be it in parts of a broadcast or even in debate shows, to do more than just superficially touch. I think that the more you do and the more specific you get, you can kind of debate that issue more and more. And even Twitter with its 140 characters, I guess if you throw out a million tweets, it's like the monkeys typing Shakespeare. Eventually, I think we can probably come to some agreement. It's just frustrating sometimes to think that because it's not constantly on the tongues of people that we're against it. Or even if we are maybe against certain aspects of it, like maybe it's just not American, it's not the way things are done here, look at the growth. I guarantee you that if the EPL had an option, and remember they kind of did by separating themselves from the Football League a while ago, if they had the option, that they would slam the door shut to make sure that the money didn't trickle down. There's so many pluses to promotion relegation, but there's minuses as well that some people don't really want to talk about, which is the possible flight of some of the funding that has lifted MLS and soccer in this country to this point. If Stan Kroenke in Colorado get relegated, who's to say he doesn't leave? Maybe the next guy comes in, has tens of millions of dollars, but that's not billions of dollars. And then if that team gets relegated, maybe the next guy has a million. If that guy gets relegated, maybe the next guy only has 100,000. I think that people that ignore the fact that money is not evil, that money is a tool, and that the best way is to get that tool to do its work correctly. If you ignore that, you're just being foolish. For example, if U.S. soccer came down and mandated promotion relegation or made these mandates on youth development, et cetera, there's a lot of very rich people that have very rich lawyers that would be arguing this ad nauseum until the league just faded away. So I think if we can all find a way to get all of us on the same page, that would be better. And again, I agree with you. It's better to be able to talk about it, to try and find those agreements. And I have a feeling that there are some conversations that are going on behind the scenes. Just saying that's a feeling. I don't know anything specifically. But I would not be surprised if NASL continues to grow, even if it might have ties with MLS, if USL continues to grow, NPSL, et cetera, that there's just going to be this pressure building that sooner or later there will be some form of merger, either legally mandated or financially and feasibly mandated by the situation, where we're going to see this happen. Is that going to happen in 5 years? No, but I wouldn't be surprised if in 20 or 30 years that this pyramid that everyone would love to see isn't already well underway.
So, in your opinion, and you've seen the progression, I guess, of U.S. soccer from, like you said, the interim time right before 1994, and I think we can all kind of agree that our modern day setup, that's kind of like the kicking off point, I guess. What's holding us back at this point now, from the growth that we've had from 1994 until 2016? What's holding us back from making that next leap?
Back in 94, I think we were at that point where the NASL seeds had started to grow, and we had seen more and more soccer people that had worked their way into the business world and were now in the boardrooms, to the point where soccer wasn't just going to be laughed off or pushed aside, that it would at least be open for a discussion. And I think with some of the people that stepped up to the plate to start MLS, there's no doubt about it. There was some big money, but it was a big risk. And I think it was necessary at that point to try and minimize that risk. Billionaires don't become billionaires without finding some way to protect their investments. Now, at the same point, I don't think many people even nowadays realize how close MLS was to failure. I mean, there was actually, from what I have been told, dissolution papers that were just awaiting signatures when they eventually elected to pull Tampa and Miami's plug. And Phil Anschutz stepped up, as did the Krafts and the Hunts, to basically keep this alive, especially Phil Anschutz. That has now proven to be a wise investment. But at the same point, I don't think people realized how close U.S. soccer was to being declared bankrupt if it hadn't qualified. If I recall, it was the 2006 World Cup. We were able to qualify, went into a difficult group, still had an amazing performance against Italy that I think with, a better referee could have gone a different direction. But people view that as a failure, but just getting there was enough to keep U.S. soccer alive, and now it's continued to grow. Since those 20, 25 years have now passed, now instead of just being in the boardroom, we have a lot of soccer people that are actually chairing boards, chairing panels. They now have control of the investment, the decision-making process. And I think we're going to see more and more of that because, be it in support locally or nationally or internationally, it helps to have the people with the money and the power behind you. Does that necessarily mean that it's going to be an oligarchy or some type of crony capitalism that some view MLS in perpetuity? No, because I think there are enough people that are starting to bubble up. You see it in Portland, you see it in Seattle, I think you see it in Toronto a bit, and certain other areas where some people that are actually in MLS are open to the possibility of discussing some form of promotion relegation and opening the pyramid. And as time progresses, I think we're going to see more of that. You also have to remember, and in some ways, I think MLS might, I don't want to use the term be a victim, but be creating a scenario whereby some form of stratification, some form of promotion relegation isn't almost mandatory. They need the money from expansion. maybe less than they did before, but at this point they still need it for survival. You have cities out there that are willing to pay, maybe not as much as Las Vegas with $500 million for an expansion NHL team, but you know what, 100 mil, 150 mil, 200 mil, it goes a long way. And with Atlanta coming in, Minnesota coming in, hopefully as a South Floridian, Miami coming in, you still have the likes of a Sacramento, the Vegas itself, St. Louis, Cincinnati. There's areas where I think you can see soccer still succeed. And I don't see things really slowing down until MLS hits 28, maybe 30, maybe 32 even. And that might be a negative to some because everyone wants that 20-team, 18-team league that FIFA likes to have your standard table and home and aways and everything like that. But you also have to remember that from a U.S. perspective, this is a gigantic country. There are very few. Maybe Brazil's the only one that can kind of claim a similar footprint. Even Russia, so much of the country population is focused on the European border. In China, it's focused on the Pacific Ocean. So even these giant countries are still somewhat centralized when it comes to their league. But we have so many population centers, so many areas where there's soccer fans that would love to see this. I mean, who would have thought of what Cincinnati has done of late and Sacramento? But I think they obviously have shown that they love this sport. So I think it's going to come to a point where MLS is continuing to grow. The advertisers want to see a bigger footprint because that means that more people are getting exposed to what they're trying to sell. Television wants to see a bigger footprint because that means more people will be likely to watch and they'll get higher ratings. But it gets to a point now, again, like I said, 30, 32 teams. And then say if NASL continues to survive and grow, either on the field, off the field, in a courtroom perhaps, meets all the stipulations of first division play, we might have an AFL, NFL, and then all of a sudden you get to the point where those teams get absorbed and it's easy to get to a 36, a 38, or a 40. And I think intra this new MLS, you could see it split into two 18 or 20 team divisions, parachute payments to, again, try and protect investment and minimize risk, just as was needed to try and get the Premier League to separate from the Football League. And now all of a sudden, I see it a little easier, actually a lot easier, to open that trap door at the bottom of that second division and maybe let some of these other USL, NPSL teams work their way in. People think that that might be too long. People might think that might be unfair, but a lot of leagues have kind of formed that way, and the fact that as they get absorbed, they kind of get absorbed into a second division and have to fight their way up to the top flight. So again, these are things that I think are going to happen over decades, but I can see the tea leaves kind of headed in that direction because there are a ton of people that love this sport in this country. And if you look at some of the polls, some of the statistics, if I recall, it was done within a year or two, and I can't remember if it was under 21 or under 25, but the millennial population, that soccer had already progressed to their second favorite sport. So again, it is a market that is going to demand to be served, which means that soccer will need to continue to grow. And I do see that pyramid growing right along with the soccer population in the States.
You mentioned before, maybe not in answering this last question, but I remember you mentioning something that we don't need to think of money as being evil. We don't need to think of these billionaires like the guys that did keep MLS afloat and probably it sounds like U.S. soccer afloat during some rough times. We don't need to think of those people as evil. But do you also think it's fair to say that money shouldn't be the only requirement to break into our top flight for soccer in this country? And I guess my train of thought goes to, it doesn't take billions of dollars, even hundreds of millions, even millions of dollars to run a successful small club and grow from there, as long as there's the end goal that you know that you can grow into, which would be top flight, MLS, or whatever it becomes in the future. You can start that with $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, and grow. And with that, the budget grows, everything grows. So on the flip side of not thinking billions are evil, can we stop thinking about the people that are trying to grow as, I guess, evil in a way as well? I know evil's a strong word, but...
Obviously, the people that have the money want to keep it. They want to see it grow. Part of that involves risk, and I think that many of them are willing to risk. However, to assume that these are only guideline stipulations that are evident in the United States is putting blinders on. I remember there was a huge fight in regards to Eibar in Spain, being such a small club. And even though they had all of their books balanced and were actually operating at a profit, they needed to borrow money to have enough money in the bank just in case. You see this around the world in regards to top flight teams being forced to have this bond to make sure that their bills get paid. I mean, it's a little different if you're looking in a 100 or a 200 or 300 mile area, and now all of a sudden you're in the big time and you're going to have to be going coast to coast. Now all of a sudden you're in the big time, and instead of paying $1,000 a game, you're going to be paying $20,000 a game to some of these players. To be able to, and you hear horror stories about what goes on in some of these countries where players, Spain, and even developed countries, Spain comes to mind because I covered a lot, where players haven't been paid for months. So I do think that you need more if you're going to be at a true top flight than just $100,000. And I know that was just an arbitrary figure, but it's not just here. I know in France there was a great Cinderella story of a team that had earned promotion, but the federation refused. I think it was the LFP actually more than the federation, refused to license them. And not only that, but basically disbanded them and pushed them down to lower division, where they just fell apart because they were in too small of a market. Even if they had money behind them, the league saw that as an untenable or unwinnable situation. Now, does that mean that I necessarily think that it should be a closed shop? No, I think that there are benefits, especially in the training wheel stage of having that closed shop and making sure you're not going to lose your shirt. But we also are getting close to that point where I think it's time to take the training wheels off. One thing I will always caution, though, is it's easy for us to spend other people's money. And you have to remember that they're the ones who stepped up. A lot of people talk about the fact that, well, if only there had been an open market in soccer. Well, between the 1930s and the 1970s, it was pretty much the Wild West. When the NASL went belly up, I know that Francisco Marcos stepped up and created USL, and that was rather wild and woolly, but there were openings, there were possibilities. It didn't work. MLS has come up with a plan that has seen stratospheric growth, that has seen stadium construction, training camp construction, youth development academies, and maybe it's just hitting a critical mass because, again, it goes with the growth, it goes with immigration, it goes with USL and the footprint that they have laid around the country in all of these smaller and mid-level markets. But I think the fact that a successful World Cup, the emergence of some might view that as a negative, but I see it as a necessary, I wouldn't even say evil, but a necessity to find a way to market this game and promote it to Madison Avenue and the advertisers. And the survival of MLS and now the thriving of MLS are all good things. I, again, I think many of us have the same goal. We just maybe have different timelines. And at the same point, if we talk about it and really get into the details, maybe even the timelines aren't that different. So to expect everything you want to make this a soccer nirvana overnight is not going to happen. In many ways, to expect MLS to do this by themselves is not going to happen. MLS is not responsible for soccer in this country. MLS is not responsible for the growth and improvement of the national team in this country. Anything that happens that improves soccer or improves the national team due to MLS is just a pleasant coincidence. What MLS is responsible for is MLS. It's putting forth a product that people are willing to pay. And if people stop paying, then MLS needs to adjust. And I think, again, from an MLS perspective, it was great to get Jozy Altidore and Michael Bradley and Clint Dempsey back. As it's proven to be, it hasn't quite worked out that well for the national team. Where the change needs to happen is at the U.S. Soccer Federation. And just like any political entity, I think if people truly believe the change needs to be made, they need to step up and put their names and their plans forward. And I know MLS, I'm not going to say it had a stranglehold, but it did have a strong grip on the U.S. Soccer Federation boards. But I think that's been lessened in recent years. And again, that's one great thing about this country. There are easy ways to kind of get into the Federation as a member. And once you are a member, you get to vote on the boards. It's a country that I think it's always rewarded put up or shut up. I'm not going to tell everyone out there to shut up, but if you truly have the passion, go out and do something. Don't just complain about it, because complaining rarely works.
I think those points that you just made are really, actually really, really important for people to start to understand. And to quote you, MLS is responsible for MLS. U.S. Soccer, whether or not they're in bed with MLS, which that's, I think, a rabbit hole that we can save for another day, but U.S. Soccer is responsible for everything in this country soccer-wise, and they're the ones that should be making the decisions. It's not MLS dictating what U.S. Soccer should be doing, and I'm actually really thankful you brought that up, because that's a point that a lot of people miss, and they talk about promotion and relegation in MLS or promotion and relegation in NASL. It's not a league issue. It's a federation issue. If there's one, I guess, kind of jumping off point where if people are coming into this conversation and they're new to this this topic, I think that's one big thing that everybody has to understand from the get-go. It's that it's a federation issue, not a league issue.
And I think that even comes with youth development. I think that's where the federation could really make itself felt. And if you have the chance to read Das Reboot from Rafa Honigstein, a very good book talking about the revolution in German soccer. I know Jürgen Klinsmann has gotten a lot of credit for it, and I think he deserves some of it for pretty much putting the cherry on top of a sundae that Franz Beckenbauer and others had built starting in 1996, realizing the change needed to happen. And they used the power of the DFB, the governing body, to license first division teams and mandate that first and second division professional teams invest a specific and significant minimum in youth development. If I recall, it's like €1 million minimum if you wanted to be first or second. And now all of a sudden you can say, oh, that maybe that's unfair. But what they're saying is if you truly want to be pro level, that is one of the criteria that you need to invest in the next generation. Now all of a sudden you're looking at €34 million minimum every year going into youth development before the federation even spends a dime. Then they also did put money in to create regional centers to try and funnel some of these youth through the national team structure, but it was a lot more organized. And I think we've kind of seen what organization can do if it's kind of mandated from a grassroots perspective with Iceland in this past Euros. But what Germany did was amazing. And I would love to see the Federation kind of mandate, even NASL. Some say that's not necessary, but in my mind, maybe it doesn't need to be $1 million a year, but it should be something significant. If you truly want to view yourself as professional, start growing your own players and prove that you are in this for the long haul. And then, like what Mexico used to do, what Colombia used to do, especially when they were in an era where local players, where there was a bit of a talent gap, they mandated that youth players actually play in the first division. I know Colombia, for the most part, if I recall, it was under 20, and there was a year or two where they actually had one under 19, one under 21, because I know there was a great argument in regards to Christian Pulisic, where it was said that, well, if he would play in MLS, he would get playing time, and I totally disagree. I think that what Thomas Tuchel has done at Dortmund is almost against the grain even of coaches everywhere. But you do see it occasionally, PSG with some of the young players, Kingsley Coman finally starting to blossom. But to truly give a teenager a chance in a meaningful game, and I don't think we've seen that enough in MLS. I think it's great that they have the academies and their reserve teams in USL. I think that's a big step in the right direction. But I would love to see some of more of these teams. I'm not saying all of them. I know some of them, I think Vancouver has done something this year. But to see these teams almost mandated that either a certain number of minutes or something be done to try and make sure that these kids get a chance to impress and get some exposure, because it's kind of hard to prove it even on a training ground or with a second division side. There's talent out there, and I know you are well aware. There's a lot of talent out there in this country that is just dying on the vine.
More than aware. Just the other day when I was watching Iceland and England, I was thinking, oh my gosh, how amazing would it be if we just had a Southern California Federation and we were able to send a team like that into Copa America or a bigger tournament, and to think that, you know, there's millions of people in Southern California, and Iceland has 330,000, and I think we have more than enough talent in just the greater Los Angeles area to put up more than a good fight. So yeah, that thought crosses my mind almost daily. So
well, you're talking about Southern California. It's not unique. I mean, in my mind, even more than California, Florida, because it's probably the only state of the union where you can play soccer 12 months a year, should be doing so much more. Going out watching my kids play, both boys and girls, you just see some amazing talent. A lot of it has to do with whether they can't afford it. A lot of it has to do with maybe they don't have the right coaching. There is no pipeline set up, and it's just really, really frustrating. I used to say, back in the earlier days of MLS, you could probably go to almost any park in South Florida, grab 20 guys, and they could beat some of these MLS teams, beat some of the better ones. I think from a fitness perspective, maybe that's changed just a little bit. But again, there's so much talent out there on all levels that I can see why so many people are so frustrated. I just don't want to kill the golden goose in the process of trying to make the egg hatch.
Oh, and that makes total sense. And to kind of elaborate on that, I guess when you have a story like Cal FC a few years ago, and they make that run in Open Cup and beat MLS or an MLS team, and that's basically what you said. It's a group of 20 guys that were playing on Sundays in a park in Southern California, and Eric Winalda was, I think, the captain of that ship and led them on their journey. And to think that that's not possible with, I think you correctly highlighted, a little extra fitness and being a professional footballer, not just somebody that has to work a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday, and then, you know, oh, we're gonna go play an MLS team on this weekend, meet you there. I think that there's a lot of those stories that can still be told, and I think the only way that they do get told is with something like a promotion and relegation and an opportunity for these players and teams and clubs and these people that are willing to invest money, whether it's millions or billions of dollars, doesn't matter the figure. If somebody's willing to invest money, my feeling, and I think a lot of people share this feeling, is that they should have the opportunity to grow. And I think when you look at teams like Detroit City FC or the Indy 11 or Carolina Railhawks, and these are teams that are kind of just infinitely cast into lower divisions, but they're still willing to invest, knowing that reaching the top level is nearly impossible, I guess only impossible if you're willing to write a big enough check at this point.
But you still have the Open Cup out there, and we saw some more action yesterday, and I wish, and I know they take it seriously, but at the same point, back in the early days when Rochester won the Open Cup, if you watched the Rhinos play, you could see, for example, if you switched the designated players from D.C. to Rochester, if all of a sudden it's Moreno, Diaz Arce, and Echeverry that were wearing green instead of black, Rochester would have been by far the better team. I think MLS has pulled away, a large part due to fitness. But I think in many ways, we need to see those teams, not to pull a Cosmos, but to make even more of an investment. I know Miami is making some big investments. Richie Ryan, they just signed Kwadwo Poku, $700,000 transfer from NYC, if I recall. A great buy, but just to see that at an NASL level, it kind of boggles the mind. Maybe, hopefully, it's a sign of things to come, as opposed to just a giant tax write-off. But they have the opportunity. And last year, NASL was completely shut out. This year, even though there were a lot of good battles, including Indiana, the Indianapolis 11 had a fantastic performance, but fell on a shootout. Fort Lauderdale the same, but were able to win the coin flip practically. I'd love to see those teams progress. They don't even have to win it all, but if you got one or two of them into a semifinal, all of a sudden people's eyes would be open. If they did win it, there's two possibilities. One, MLS does like the original NASL did, takes their ball and goes home, realizing that there's nothing for them to win in this tournament, that they can only lose. However, I think that the soccer community has gotten to the point where they would view that with such negativity that MLS would lose even more face. I would love to see the day where an NASL or a USL or an NPSL team just takes it all the way to the house and ends up getting a chance to lift the trophy. And until we see teams seriously challenge, just as we talk about MLS seriously challenging for the CONCACAF Champions League, something that really hasn't happened since Real Salt Lake a few years ago prior to this last batch of expansion, which kind of weakened, and also with the salary cap limitations, moving players around seriously weakened some powerful teams. Until MLS can really compete with Mexico, I think it's kind of foolish to talk about how great you are or could be. Until NASL and these other teams can seriously compete with MLS, I think it's the same. Now, you're absolutely right. If all of a sudden you hand over the keys and you can see that ladder climbing to the top of the pyramid, that would greatly increase incentive. Arguably, maybe there might be a little time lag, but increase investment. I think that will happen. If they can do it with what they have right now, I think it might speed up the process.
And obviously we have to wrap up soon. I've kept you for way too long, longer than we had kind of initially agreed on.
I think you should probably send a scarf and a t-shirt to anyone that's listened to this whole.
Most definitely. Yeah. I really want to kind of put one narrative to rest, and I'm hoping you can agree with me on this one. Do you think it's appropriate to say we can ditch the soccer hasn't arrived narrative at this point in 2016?
there is still so much more to do, so much more that it can grow in this country. But considering the fact that just by its size, the soccer community in the United States dwarfs almost every other nation on earth, I would agree 100%. However, like I said, more that can be done. Television ratings are improving. Attendance is improving, but there's still so much more. For example, Copa America Centenario, so many people bitching, deservedly, rightfully, about the price of tickets. And you saw huge swaths, especially in that VIP range, of empty seats. Still, it was the most successful financial Copa America in history. They just misread the market. I think if they would have lowered ticket prices a little bit, they probably could have sold out almost every game and arguably made even more money. But I'll leave that up to the accountants. But in my mind, you take a look at the Argentinian fans that showed up, maybe just to see Lionel Messi, the Colombian fans that showed up, maybe just to see James Rodriguez, the Mexican fans who would show up regardless of who was wearing the green. They maybe argued, maybe complained, but they put their money down. So I would say that that shows a strength in a market that we don't necessarily see in the U.S. soccer community. And like I said, it was money gouging. It was carpet bagging. The fact that ticket prices were actually set and, from what I understand, totally and wholly controlled by the U.S. Soccer Federation means that they were in on this shell game, if you wish, just as much as CONMEBOL and CONCACAF were, and arguably perhaps even worse, because the job of the federation is to grow soccer in this country, and I think filled stadiums watching all of these games does so much more because it makes the fans active. They actually step forward and do something rather than just sit on their couch. So again, I think that we are a soccer country, but we're a soft soccer country. We need to do something to become more active, more passionate. And I'm not saying it's just being able to go out there and shell $150 out to buy a ticket, but you can see that other cultures that grew up with this sport were willing to do that. It was that valuable. Like I said, money is a tool, and what that tool does is to determine what has value. For the Mexican fans, their national team had that value. For the U.S. soccer fans, not so much. So again, we've grown a ton over the last quarter century. There's still a lot of growth to go, though.
And real quick, and we can kind of make this, I guess, the last question, but I'm just curious, and I know that you have more insider knowledge than I do, and you have access to look at the ratings and things like that, but I mean, you work for a network that shows Barca and Real Madrid, and I think you can vouch that people in this country are tuning in. They're watching soccer, whether the game, I think, typically is, for me, on the West Coast, it shows like around 11:30 or noon. But how do you explain the differences in the viewer ratings when it comes to MLS compared to BN's Barca and Real Madrid broadcasts? And what, if anything, that you can think of is preventing more people from watching MLS? And then also, how do our ratings, whether it's the Premier League games that get broadcast on NBC at 6 o'clock in the morning and your Barca and Real Madrid broadcast, how do those numbers stack up to numbers in other countries? How many more people or less people are watching soccer in this country on television than they are, say, in South America or in Europe? That's something I think I've never asked before, and I've never seen the answer to.
Well, from a percentage, and again, you have to remember you have the audience and you have the share. The percentage of the televisions that are turned on at that particular point might be relatively high, but if it's at 6 a.m. in the morning, the total number of sets are relatively low, so the actual number of people watching might not be that high. I do think that what NBC has done with the Premier League has shown that there is a market. Is that a market that is interested in anything else that's not Premier League? I mean, the fact that the Premier League has struggled at the international level, that England was abysmal in the Euros, doesn't seem to be turning those fans off. You could argue in some part that it's cultural more than it is reality. I think from a Barca Real perspective, it is the showcase. It's showtime on both sides. And you obviously are going to draw the headlines when you have two of the best players in the history of the game going head to head, especially with the fact that they have such other talented players playing alongside of them. Still, when you take a look at share in the developed soccer world, I mean, not including like the likes of, say, an Australia or a New Zealand or even a South Africa, although some ratings there for their Premier League are phenomenal. The actual share is low. The numbers are climbing. I would agree with you the fact that MLS is still a third, a fifth sometimes, as much of an audience as some of these big matches or more, shows that they have a lot of growing to do. The positive is the fact that you do have those audiences that are already exposed to and passionate about soccer that they can draw on. And I think eventually you're going to see that shrink a little bit. Mentioned in earlier podcasts, I don't know if I think I've brought this up here, but there is no better place to live on earth if you want to watch your soccer than the United States, especially with internet now, but even before with just all of the television networks that cover it as a principal part of their broadcasting, from the big networks to the more sports specific networks like BN Sports. And I know we're the fastest growing network among the Nielsen rated categories, so there is continued growth there. That there are 60, 70 networks that focus in on all of these various leagues from around the world. And it's so comfortable to sit back on your couch or sit at your desk and watch on the screen than it is to get up, hop in the car, go to the stadium, sweat, get through the lines, wait to drive out of the parking lot. And like I said, that's part of the situation where I think the U.S. Soccer Federation failed a little bit in this Copa America, from turning those passive fans into a more active variety. I still think there's a lot of growth that needs to happen. You still take a look at these gigantic ratings that the Premier League or these super, or these Clasicos get, and they are still dwarfed by more traditional sports in the U.S. So again, there's still a lot of growth. I think people that think that the current soccer community is enough for soccer to survive and thrive in this country are fooling themselves. Am I saying we need to corrupt the sport or bastardize it to make it more palatable? No, but I do think we need to go out and spread the good word a little bit more and be willing to realize that that there are people that might not love it as much as we do yet, but we all started, as we like to say in my church group, everyone starts at the table of contents. And I think sometimes the people on Twitter can be their own worst enemies by alienating potential fans before soccer has really taken root. So again, the ratings are good. The ratings are climbing. MLS, not so much, but still on an upswing. I just think it's going to take more time, more effort, more youth development, more Landon Donovans, more David Beckhams to draw the headlines as well. It all has to be that perfect recipe that comes together. And eventually, I think it will, regardless. I think we've already reached that critical mass. I'm just kind of hoping that we don't shoot ourselves in the foot.
All right, Phil. Like I said, I appreciate every second you've given me today. It looks like just over an hour worth of conversation between us two. I do want to ask one last question, because I did throw it on Twitter that people could submit some stuff, and I think this is one that people will like as a last one. But somebody asked, and it looks like Darken NYC, so at Darken NYC, asked, how long does it take Ray Hudson to prepare his glorious descriptions?
Well, like I said, he's one of the reasons I fell in love with this sport even more, getting the chance to watch him as a teenager, playing with the likes of a Gerd Müller and a Nene Kubiš and George Best and not missing a beat. He was just the joy that he had on the field from playing the game is the same joy that he has in real life, and to get the chance to work with him and see him up close and personal has been a true blessing. It's a combination. Some people think that he just sits in his dungeon with this gas lamp trying to come up and script every little thing. Other people think that he comes in totally unprepared and just lets it fly. It's a combination. He goes through, and he's a very educated man, and scribbles notes, scribbles ideas down, but then kind of weaves them in as the situation might warrant. So I'd say, how much work does it take? It's in between spur of the moment and a lifetime.
I think that's a good answer. It's a great answer. If people want to continue the conversation with you and pick your brain a little bit more, where can they find you? Where can they reach you at?
Well, again, they can watch whenever we get the chance on Extra and on The Locker Room, which is going to be on tonight. And I said we're probably on Friday going to be doing a little bit more about the U.S. performance at the Copa America. And that's at 7 o'clock for Extra, 7:30 for Locker Room, plus replays if you check out beinsports.com. But obviously the easiest way to actually communicate is via Twitter, PH. ILSCHOEN. And there's also a link on my Twitter page to the Facebook page, which you don't have that 140 character limit and can get in a little bit more depth. But I'm always welcome. Like I said, I am blessed to be able to do what I do. I know I don't know everything. I'm always learning every day. And as all of us are fans, I think we can all grow together.
And I agree 100%, Phil. I appreciate your time, and thank you for joining me on this podcast. I know this is a little fish, and you're in the big ocean when it comes to media. But making time for me means a lot, and means a lot to the people that are going to listen in as well. So thank you, and we'll interact again soon, hopefully.
Look forward to it. And John, again, the work that you guys do with 343. Both on the field and online is valuable. And one of these days, I'd love to see that philosophy blossom, not just on an MLS level, but also on a national team level, and getting the chance to watch the kids put into use and to practice what you guys preach gives me faith in the future of soccer in this country, and why, again, watching what we saw this past summer, some people are saying it's the lack of talent. Some people are saying it's Jurgen Klinsmann. What I know is that we can be better and we will be better, and I can hardly wait.
And us too. It's coming. It's coming. Just put it. I'll leave it at that.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, John.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Summit, 343's live in-person coaching, education, and networking experience, taking place July 29th through 31st in Las Vegas, Nevada at Palms Resort and Casino. This year, the summit will be headlined by Hugo Perez, Sasha Vandermost, and Brian Kleiben. Hugo Perez is a former U.S. men's national team player and U.S. youth national team coach. During Hugo's time with the youth national teams, he was widely recognized as having implemented something different, a possession-based style of play. Sasha Vandermost is currently a scout for the Mexican Football Federation. Formerly the academy director at Chivas USA, Sasha is the one who brought Brian Kleiben on board at Chivas, and through his leadership, built what came to be known as one of the best youth academies in the country. And 343's own Brian Kleiben, who is now with LA Galaxy's Youth Academy, is continuing to develop players for the professional game with a style and in a setting that is unlike any other in the United States today. Topics at the summit will include individual activities, implementing style of play at team and club level, scouting, session planning, getting parents, players, and club members to buy into what you're trying to do, and more. This is an opportunity to dive deeper into how it's done with presentations from guys who have actually done it. Find more information about the summit by visiting 343coaching.fm. That's the number 3, the number 4, the number 3, coaching.fm, and clicking on live services in the upper right corner.